and where Bravo Zulu got talked into using 3/4-inch diameter tubing. That's way larger than required. Quarter-inch copper tubing would have been enough, in my opinion. 3/4-inch copper tubing at 40 meters, that's a ridiculous diameter. We're getting down to nano-ohms, and it's way beyond the law of diminishing returns as to the amount of copper being used versus the efficiency of radiation. You got a first hit resonance of that big loop, and then you got to hit a reasonable impedance match between the small loop and the large loop. The fact that the large loop is a small number of wavelengths in diameter does not lower the efficiency. The only way an antenna can have low efficiency is that you put 100 watts into it, and 90 watts turns into heat because the copper turns hot. There is no other inefficiency method when you get a good impedance match. If you put a thermal imaging camera on the antenna and you put a few watts into it for 5 minutes, and if it's not glowing on that camera, it is not inefficient. I've got some strong opinions on that one. You're expressing good common sense, and you'll hear a zillion people on 20 meters saying that every day. And they also say that every rubber duck antenna is low in efficiency. Not true. Got some strong opinions on that one. Over to you first, Andy, and then we'll go over to BZ. Roy. AC2GS, K2LIW.
Okay, very good, Dick. Well, I feel weird disagreeing with you. You're the pro, I'm the pure amateur. The way that I understand it is that on a theoretical basis of the aperture is the same. I understand that, and the theoretical loss is non-distinguishable. But in the real world where there's insertion losses, the shorter you make things, in addition to the Q, the lower your radiation resistance, and the lower your radiation resistance, the more a factor insertion loss in your transmission line becomes. And then that's my understanding of why I'm saying that it's inefficient, not because of some guy on HF telling me that. But that's the kind of vague understanding that at least I bring to it. Maybe I'm completely wrong, but I think it has to do with insertion losses. Now, it's true. If you get Jet Propulsion Lab to build your entire transmission line and use superconductors, and so the insertion loss is zero, then you get the full efficiency. But the problem is that most things that amateur radios cobble together have a significant amount of insertion loss.
Again, Roy, you're using very good common sense. If he's using a reasonable 50-ohm transmission line, I don't care if it's RG58U, and he's using 30 feet of it, 20 feet of it, at HF frequencies, that doesn't have very much loss. And if the antenna on the far end of that has an input impedance match of 50 ohms, it's going to absorb all the power from your transmission line. Even if the radiation resistance is a milliohm, that doesn't matter. That just tells you how difficult the impedance match is on the input structure between the input connector and the actual ring that's doing the resonating and radiating. But the radiation resistance is not something that's reasonable in this case. If the antenna gives you a reasonable standing wave ratio, and if you do a good job of impedance matching, it will give you a good standing wave ratio, at least at one frequency. It may be very narrow band, but at least at one frequency, you can tune it to give a good impedance match. And once you, if you're running 10 watts into the antenna, and you're not getting 9 watts reflected, if you're only getting 1 watt reflected due to standing wave ratio, and 9 watts is being absorbed, and if the antenna is not getting hot to the touch, you put 10 watts into an antenna, and you do it for 5 minutes, and if it's inefficient, something is going to get hot. And if the antenna runs ice cold, there is no other mechanism of inefficiency. You can have a lot of reflection from an antenna, that's standing wave ratio. Knock that down with good impedance match, and after that, the only inefficiency of an antenna is it's turning the energy into heat. And if it's not turning the energy into heat, and if it's not reflecting it to the transmitter, there's nothing left. It is being radiated. Even though it is too small in wavelengths and you think it's inefficient, everybody believes that. Let's see what Rich has got to say now. Let's hope we're hearing him. Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu, K2LIW. For whatever reason, PL tone or the transmitter, I mean the repeater, giving us trouble tonight. I'm not quite sure. We're not hearing anything from Bravo Zulu. So, Roy, it's time for you to continue. And you're saying good common sense. A lot of people believe it, but I think it's a strong misunderstanding of a lot of people about radiation resistance and inefficiency. If the antenna is not reflecting the power, and if it's not turning it into heat, there is no other mechanism of inefficiency other than reflected power and heat. AC2GS, K2IW.
AC2GS. Okay, Dick, I believe you. And one of these days, I actually purchased a thermal probe, one of those thermal images that I can plug into my iPhone, with the idea of doing some thermal experiments of running power and seeing how much warmer the coaxial cable gets. And unfortunately, I've been lazy with that, but one of these days, I'm going to have to pull out that stuff and do a little bunch of experiments.
Yeah, but the only way your transmission line can run hot, if you're putting a kilowatt into it with high standing wavage, you've got... If you've got reasonable loss in your transmission line and a reasonable standing wave ratio on the far end, and you're not running 1,500 watts into it, you're not going to measure any significant amount of heat of a piece of RG8U, in my opinion. Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
Okay, I mean, yeah, I can see where that. Well, I wouldn't expect too much attenuation loss in the lower HF band in general. It's just, you know, sometimes people don't quite understand how attenuation loss works, and they'll run RG58, they'll run something like 50 feet of it to an outside antenna for their 440, and they don't quite understand why their signal isn't so hot.
Yeah, I do admit that RG58 has something like 14.5 dB of loss per 100 feet at 450 megahertz. 14.5 dB per 100 feet. So RG58 and 100 feet of it is not the right transmission line for 70 centimeters. What do you write?
Okay. Also, I'm not 100% sure. I mean, obviously, Rich knows exactly what his copper tubing is. I always thought it was much thinner than 3/4. I thought it was the type of tubing that usually you buy at Home Depot for your refrigerator to run the water supply. I don't remember if those are 3/8 inch or something close to that, because I've seen other people with pictures of their magnetic loops made out of that material, and you can tell that it's not really that wide. So I don't know if Rich actually got rather significant 3/4 inch tubing, or maybe he's using something a wee bit smaller than that.
He said 3/4 inch, so maybe it's 3/4 inch soft, bendable, or 3/4 inch rigid. Doesn't matter. 3/4 inch is way beyond the requirement. That's 5 times too big in diameter, in my opinion. Go ahead. That's very hard to live with, mechanically.
3/8, not 3/4. 3/8, not 3/4. I misspoke.
Okay. That's a lot more reasonable. A lot more reasonable, Rich. And, Rich, we're hearing you now. We haven't been hearing you for a long time. Got anything else you want to tell to us? Bravo Zulu, K2IW.
Except to give me a call before he buys his loop, his $450 loop.
Okay. Who's the person you're talking about? I missed that.
Ask GXM.
Okay. And GXM, did you get a chance to ask all your questions before we move on to Roy?
I did indeed, Dick, and I'm not going to get this high-priced thing anytime soon. I have no money. I have a lot of research to do, but I have no money. Back to you and to Roy.
Yeah, with enough research, you're going to find web articles where you can homebrew a loop antenna for a lot lower price, in my opinion. AC2GS, K2IW, you got it, Roy.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Dick. Let me just remind everyone, you think everyone would know this by now, but just in case some people are showing up new, if you have any questions, if you have any mailbag questions for Dick, unfortunately, I didn't get any mailbag questions for you this week, but if you have any mailbag questions of a technical nature that you would like to ask Dick, but you can't get on to the net, if you have any space report questions that you'd like to ask Paul or tell Paul about something that he might be interested in, or if you want to contact me either to give me suggestions or ask topics that you'd like discussed or offer me puzzlers, because I'm always looking for puzzlers, then the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And everything that I talk about, which isn't probably going to be a lot because I only got 45 minutes, it will be on my link page, roy.ac2gs.com. Again, roy.ac2gs.com. It will also include a link to a PDF file for a small manual for that nano-VNA so you can get a sense of what it's capable of. Also, like I always mention, we have a chat room that's kind of underpopulated right now. You can get there by typing chat.ac2gs.com. And I also do an audio stream of the Technical Net from my shack. We have two people listening through that. So that's technet.ac2gs.com. Let me drop and I'll go on to my puzzler. Okay, for tonight's puzzler, I thought I might retrace a line of conversation that I had years ago with Silent Key now, familiar to many of you here, John KC2WGB, who used to do this mailbag job as before me. John and I shared a fascination for engineering, but also a history of engineering. Now, I've often talked about our times as the golden age of science and technology, and I still believe this to be true, but our ancestors were a clever bunch, and they sometimes came up with engineering solutions that we have yet to completely figure out. I mean, just to name a few of these, just think about the fabled seven wonders of the ancient world listed by the Greeks. There was the Great Pyramid of Giza, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, the Temple of Artemis at Ephesus, the Statue of Zeus at Olympia, the Mausoleum of Halicarnassus, and the Colossus of Rhodes, not to mention the Lighthouse of Alexandria. All those seven wonders, only one remains around today. Let me drop for a sec. And as I've mentioned before, I kind of get annoyed when popular books write about alien visitations and sort of refuse to think that those clever human beings could have possibly accomplished any of these feats and prefer to use these engineering feats as some weird proof of alien visitation. Well, anyway, this is all to set the stage to discuss one very clever invention of the ancient world, which, if you'll indulge me, I'll describe rather than give the name for at this point. Now, it looks like a large, I'm talking about, you know, 5, 6, 7 feet long, a large metal screw-like mechanism. It's usually tilted around 45 degrees, and by rotating this screw-like device, different material, mostly water, can be raised from lower levels to higher levels without the use of pails and pulleys and such. It's very effective in transferring water from low-lying bodies of water into higher irrigation ditches. So I was just wondering if my description for this ancient marvel of engineering was good enough for some of you to picture it in your mind's eye and perhaps name that device. So in addition to its name, bonus points will be gotten if you can tell me who invented it and approximately where and approximately when. So, anyone out there have an idea what kind of device I'm talking about?
W2ASC.
Say it, see.
Archimedes screw, sometime in Greece, a long time ago.
Okay. That is one of the names for it. It's Archimedes screw. It was in Greece a long time ago. Well, okay. Would you hazard a guess of who invented Archimedes' screw then?
I was always under the impression it was Archimedes, but perhaps I'm wrong.
Okay. Anyone else with any suggestions? Okay, I kind of presented this puzzler to Dick in email as a kind of a rip-off of Who's Buried in Camp 2. And the answer seems obvious to some people when they first get tricked into it. No one's buried in Grant's tomb. Grant and his wife are entombed in their tomb, not buried in it. The Archimedes screw is probably the oldest known example of something called a positive displacement pump, but actually it predates Archimedes by a very long time. There's no real proof that Archimedes ever actually suggested that it was his invention, but he may have popularized it. He saw it in Egypt and kind of spread the word. And centuries later, they kind of stamped it as Archimedes' design, but it predates him. Babylonian cuneiforms suggest that those hanging gardens of Babylon that I alluded to earlier actually got their water by rotating action of large brass screws, something like an Archimedes screw. The hanging gardens of Babylon were built in the reign of the Assyrian king Sennacherib, around 600 BCE. But there are cuneiforms that suggest that this technology was known and used as far back as 300 years before the hanging gardens were ever built. Now, whoever the clever Babylonian or Assyrian or Egyptian might have been who first came up with the clever idea, unfortunately, it seems to be lost to history. But these engineering feats are a testament to the innate cleverness of humanity, be they modern or ancient. So the bottom line is, although we call it very often the Archimedes screw, it's also known as the Egyptian screw. It probably predates the Egyptian use hundreds of years before Archimedes mentioned it, and may go as far back as 1,000 years BCE, which is a long, long time ago. I'll drop for any questions or comments.
It's got a screw thread to it, but it's got to be, that screw thread has to be contained into an outer cylinder that gives you a reasonably good seal between the top of the screw threads and the cylinder. I think there has to be an outer screw thread for it to really capture the water and raise it to a higher altitude. Am I wrong on that one, Roy? AC2GS, K2RIW?
But yeah, it's usually fitted in a cylindrical sleeve, but the thing that does the magic is the motion of those screws. And it's interesting, if you go that far back, of course that predates anything like a screw that we are very familiar with. We sort of take it for granted that nails and screws have been around since the wheel. But in fact, the nail predates the screw by thousands of years. It's only been economically feasible to produce reasonably good quality screws in the last few hundred years with the advent of machinery that can do such things.
A good mechanical engineering friend of mine used to call a nail an interfibrous frictional fastener. Pretty rude.
As good as any way of describing it. I mean, there was a time most carpenters didn't use, they didn't have screws, and they didn't quite use that many nails. That's the kind of age of high-level carpentering that the dovetail joints and all kinds of very, very meticulous carpenter joints were used instead of any screws or such. So, you know, I mean, everything that we take for granted has an interesting history behind it of what it once was and how it developed and the nooks and crannies it took from one civilization to another.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
The screw would be an extension of the original inclined plane, you know, a continuous inclined plane. So, you know, one thing comes from another.
Like most things, I mean, nothing, it just kind of springs out of its own creation. It's people sit around and they think about things and they think about what works and how to make it better and how to twist it a little bit this way or that and improve it dramatically. And it's all, you know, thought. That's kind of supports the great pyramid of people. And you kind of, you know, those guys were very clever. You know, I mean, they knew how to do three-dimensional geometry very nicely. And to read these von Däniken books that suggest that little green men from Alpha Centauri popped down and basically built it for us is kind of insulting. Those clever engineers of our past, it really annoyed me when I used to see those publications show up on the bestseller list. Any other questions or comments, or I'll move on to my stories. Okay, scientists, and especially science fiction fans, have been talking about suspended animation for many years. The idea that the functions of the human body can somehow be put on pause while life-saving medical procedures were performed or a person is sent into space, just like that movie Aliens, has long seemed untenable until now. According to New Scientist, doctors have successfully placed humans in suspended animation for the first time in a trial that could have an enormous influence on the future of emergency room surgery. The technique is officially called Emergency Preservation and Resuscitation, EPR, and is being tested at the University of Maryland Medical Center on patients that arrive with acute trauma, such as stab wounds or gunshots. Given the nature of their injuries, these patients would normally have a survival rate of less than 5%. With emergency preservation and resuscitation, the patient is cooled rapidly by placing their blood with replacing their blood with ice-cold saline. The heart stops beating, the brain activity almost completely stops. At normal body temperatures, cells need a constant supply of oxygen to remain alive, but the cold temperature slows or stops the chemical reactions in the cells, which need less oxygen as a result. The human brain can survive for around 5 minutes without oxygen before damage occurs. But through emergency preservation and resuscitation, a surgical team has 2 hours to work on the patient's injuries before they're warmed up and their heart is restarted. According to Samuel Fisherman, part of the team at the Baltimore facility, full results of the trial are expected to be announced by the end of 2020. There are still factors to work through. While Dr. Tishman's team has put a cool limit of 2 hours on a human body, it's not entirely clear exactly how long a person could remain in suspended animation without suffering any physical side effects. Nevertheless, Dr. Tishman says the team is learning a lot as it moves forward with the trial. Quote, "I want to make clear that we're not trying to send people off to Saturn," he said. "We're trying to buy ourselves more time to save lives." Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Can you imagine how a person will feel, Roy, if they were conscious during the time that they start pumping cold, and I presume it's numbers like 60 degrees Fahrenheit, saline solution into your body instead of blood? Can you imagine what that must feel like? And do you lose consciousness right away? Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
I would tend to think that they wouldn't start this on someone who hadn't already gone into shock in the first place. I mean, otherwise, it could be scary as heck. Every so often, you'll read these terrible stories of anesthesiologists who... Anesthesiologists give people cocktails that do different things. Some of them just kind of knock out motor control. Others knock out your consciousness. If you don't get enough of the stuff that knocks out your consciousness and just knock out their motor control, you basically have a completely alert person who can't yell out, "Stop doing that," as they get cut open in an operation. That occasionally, rare, but occasionally happens, scary as anything. There's also a kind of a stroke which produces what's called locked-out syndrome, in which it just undermines the control lines for your muscle control. And so you become basically a statue. You can hear everything, you can feel everything, you can understand everything, but you can't move anything.
That sounds like a kind of nightmare that some people have woken up to.
Indeed, I mean, of all the terrible, terrible things to happen to a person, this strikes one of the most awful. Again, you'll read, because these people tend to sue the anesthesiologists up, down, and sideways. They will, in minute detail, describe the sensations that they had, and it sounds like anyone's worst nightmare quadrupled. Other comments or questions before I move on to my next story, which is about one of our favorite subjects, Elon Musk.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Why do these anesthesiologists give people, when you go in for an operation, you know, I went in for, you know, just a regular operation, and, you know, I figured, oh, well, I'm going to count backwards to 10 or something. And they said, oh, you won't need to do that. I didn't make it to 1. I mean, I was gone. What the heck is in this stuff?
Oh, it's all kinds of fun stuff. I mean, it's a cocktail. You got to realize that people do residencies in this field to just kind of learn the different cocktails available and how to titrate them. Anesthesiology is a lot, I'm told, like flying a commercial airplane. Although Hank probably knows far better than me. It's hours and hours of boredom punctuated by seconds of sheer terror. There's a lot of things. There's muscle relaxants. There's paralytic agents. There's a lot of material that's just meant to tranquilize you and calm you. And then there's finally a whole bunch of products that just disrupt your consciousness. And what's interesting is that even to this day, we're not 100% sure how that consciousness gets interrupted. We know so little about the brain that we don't quite know how consciousness really works. We have some clues, we have some ideas, but we really don't fundamentally know why these chemicals get into our brain and turns off the memory switch. But they do, thankfully. Most times, anesthesia is both effective and leaves no side effect. But every so often, anesthesiologists are human beings. They're capable of errors and picking up the wrong vial or giving the wrong dose, and hell occurs in those circumstances very, very occasionally.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
You said turn off the memory. Now, I think they have amnesia-inducing factors also, and that kind of scares me too, because if, as you described, someone went through all that torture, the end didn't tell about it. It's interesting philosophically.
You sort of stuck with, you know, and I hate to once again mention that the philosophy net will begin at 12:07 here. A philosophical question. If you traumatize a person and don't leave any residual damage and they don't have a memory of it happening, does that particularly, I don't even know how you would then figure out that that happened, but if it did happen, what would be the philosophical punishment for doing that by accident? I don't know. It's all possible that on some level your brain senses something's going on with your surgery, but because you can no longer store it in your short-term memory system, it doesn't really affect you, which then probably ends up being a good thing.
Hello, CB.
Yes, Greg.
I find it interesting that mistakes can happen and you somehow awaken during this stuff, but at the same time, you're like frozen and you can't do anything. And because your brain is like shut down at the moment, you probably won't even be able to remember what even happened.
Well, if you don't remember what happened, then you can't remember that something happened. So it's kind of self-redundantly negating each other. One of the other things, unfortunately, that sometimes happens, and again, it's very difficult to tell the real ones from the imagined ones, because sometimes people kind of hallucinate things, too. But there have been cases where people were put under anesthesia successfully. They had a procedure done, and then they have residual memories of the conversations that the surgical team had while they were operating on them, which you know, is not a nice thing to have happen, because unfortunately, surgeons are kind of banal people, like most people. They'll talk about, you know, where they had dinner the night before while they're doing an operation. And if it's your body they're operating on, you really don't want to remember them discussing how the lobster tasted.
Excellent.
Yes, Rich.
Many years ago, which I'm not going to discuss what it was, and I did not remember what exactly happened or what the conversations were about. I was, like, completely under anesthesia and from start to finish.
Well, that's very common, that you don't remember these things, and probably that's a good thing. And then sometimes, unfortunately, you have a breakthrough where you actually do remember bits and pieces, although it probably is rather confusing and might not be an accurate depiction. And then sometimes you just hallucinate and you just insert false memories and you know, they have no relationship to reality. But all of those are possible, unfortunately. Surgery tends to be necessary when it's done. It has risks, it has benefits. There's some belief that when you go through for bypass surgery and you have to be put on a bypass machine that takes the place of your heart and lungs for a little while, that people have gotten out of that operation with a couple of IQ points down, unfortunately. Again, nothing hard and fast to prove that, but it's at this point somewhat anecdotal, but they're doing studies to document what might cause it.
Jacob?
Yes, Rich.
They give you killed Michael Jackson.
Hey, Rich W2BZ, wait until after WB2GXM, because he was first, even, I think, around the same time as Craig. So first WB2GXM, we have too many Richards here, and then you to W2BZ. So first GXM.
Thank you. And a quick question about, on average, what happens to people's teeth when they go under anesthesia? Do they clamp down? Do they have any damage to the teeth? Or is the mouth relaxed enough where that's not a factor?
That's a very interesting question. Matter of fact, though, if you've seen enough decent television shows, you might know that there's a tube coming out of everyone's mouth. When you anesthetize someone sufficiently, local anesthesia is a different thing entirely. It makes you goofy, forgetful, what have you, but it doesn't knock you unconscious. General anesthesia does knock you unconscious and knocks out your ability to breathe. So the anesthesiologist has to supply help on that. What they do is they place something called an endotracheal tube in your mouth, down your throat, and into your bronchial canal to feed both the right and the left lung. You have to make sure and listen on both lungs because if you put it too far in, it might go into one lung and block the other. So you put it right above the branching of the right and left lung. You inflate a little air balloon so it holds on to your trachea, and you go. That tends to leave about a 3/4 inch rubber plastic tube in your mouth. So they'll tape the mouth so it doesn't move around, but for all intents and purposes, you have a plastic tube in your mouth for the entire experience.
Oh, what fun. Well, thank you, Roy. Question answered.
Welcome. Very few people bring that up, so thank you for that. W2BZ, you had a question or a comment?
GXM, by the way, if you'd like to give me a call about buying versus building a loop, please do, if you can hear this. Roy, isn't what they give you under anesthesia what Michael Jackson overdosed from? That's number one. And what about the residual pain after you come out of it?
Well, for the most part, anesthesia is not a painkiller per se. It knocks you unconscious, but it's not like an opiate. And opiates are probably not the favorite ingredient in cocktails that anesthesiologists go to, sort of. So mostly you have these short-acting materials that clear the body after you can finish the operation, because you don't want them to sit around unconscious for the next, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 hours. So you want things that are very short-lived in your body. And the painkiller that Michael Jackson was using to go to sleep and for other reasons is just an incredibly strong opiate. I forget exactly the orders of magnitude, but probably something like 50 or 60 times dose for dose more effective than morphine, which is a rather effective opiate. I don't know how frequently that's used these days. It's unfortunately misused much more than it's used. A very effective painkiller, but very dangerous. It has a very narrow usefulness/toxicity ratio. It's very easy to kill people with that stuff.
Was that propofol that he was given?
Yes, it was. The rationale at the time, and you never quite know what the real story is with Michael Jackson, was that he was a chronic insomniac. And the idea of prescribing that for insomnia I think it did get the guy's license pulled. I don't think it was permanently pulled. I think it was just temporarily pulled. But it should have been pulled, and they should have whacked him with something. So he wouldn't do it again. But that was a total abuse of his license, and a rich guy paying someone off for drugs is all it amounted to.
Isn't propofol used on many anesthesia operations these days? And I have the impression that it's quite successful and has very little after effects when properly used.
Well, anesthesia agents kind of change over time. People kind of fall in love with, the anesthesiologists fall in love with cocktails, and then they get tired of them. I think propofol kind of peaked at least 5, 6 years ago. I might be wrong. It was always part of a cocktail, though. It wasn't kind of the main ingredient. And, some of these anesthesiologists, sometimes I think that if they simplified things and you just required a kind of a cookbook, then you have anesthetists, and anesthesiologists really don't like the idea of people who didn't go to a medical school getting their job. So I don't know if these nuanced little adjustments are necessary or just excuses for higher credentialed people, but it was extremely popular, and that kind of is one of the ways that it kind of became so easy to abuse. If it sells to anesthesiologists, then pharmacies tend to have it stocked. Although I think in Michael Jackson's case, He was getting this prescribed by someone like a dermatologist, which makes no sense to me. Any other questions, or I'll move on to the next story. Okay, more than a few people have questions if Elon Musk's Starlink satellites are going to have a significant impact upon both amateur and professional stargazers. Astronomers at the Chilean observatory were rudely interrupted earlier this past week when a SpaceX satellite train consisting of 60 Starlink satellites drifted overhead in what scientists are apparently going to have to accept as the new normal. Launched into orbit on November 11th, the Starlink SmallSat train took 5 minutes to pass over the Cerro Tololo Inter-American Observatory in Chile, according to a tweet from the astronomer Clare Martinez Velasquez. Wow, I am in shock, end quote, tweeted Martinez Vasquez. The huge amount of Starlink satellites crossed our skies tonight. Our dark energy camera exposures were heavily affected by 19 of them, to which he then added rather depressingly, this is not cool. Responding to this tweet, astronomer Cliff Johnson, a team member and a Sierra postdoc fellow in astronomy at Northwestern, tweeted out a view of the disrupted data showing an array of satellite trails strewn across an image of space. The astronomers were collecting data using the Dark Energy Camera Instrument, a high-performance wide-field imager on the CTIO Blanco 4-meter telescope as part of the DELV survey, which is currently mapping the outer fringes of the large and small Magellanic clouds, as well as a significant fraction of the southern sky at optical wavelengths. Key goals of the project are to study the stellar halo around the Magellanic clouds and detect new dwarf galaxies in orbit around the clouds or the nearby Milky Way. But this research was punctuated as the Starlink train passed overhead during the early morning of Monday, November 18th. In this case, one out of about 40 exposures we took during our half night of observations were affected by the satellite trails, Johnson told reporters. And in the case of that single exposure, a maximum of 15% of the image was affected by the trails. Beyond the image itself, we also had to be careful as the trail-affected image also impacted our survey operations due to the large number of image artifacts biasing our quality control measurements. Let me drop for a second. Taken as a whole, however, these numbers tend to show that the effect on our science was more on the annoyance level rather than total disruption, he wrote. That said, this may only be the beginning of problems for astronomers, so I believe the community reaction and alarm is warranted, he said. Should the proposed sizes of these satellite mega-constellations, which are projected to include upwards of tens of thousands of individual elements, actually be achieved, that has the potential to significantly impact our observational data, said Johnson. A similar thing happened earlier this year after the first batch of 60 Starlink satellites were delivered to orbit, with some people even believing they were UFOs. Alarmed by the inaugural batch of Starlink satellites, the U.S. American Astronomical Society issued a warning, saying that mega constellations could threaten scientific observations of space. The train effect, in which the satellites are lined up neatly in a bright row, is a temporary one. Eventually, the small sats disperse and enter into their own unique orbits in a process that takes a few weeks. That said, the number of objects in space, dispersed or not, is about to experience a dramatic uptick. As it stands, the impacts of these satellite trains remain manageable and the worst effect temporarily, Johnson told reporters. He said, I agree with the tone of the recent IAU statement that calls for immediate meaningful discussions between regulators, satellite providers, and astronomers to highlight ways that impact the impact to astronomy can be minimized, and not just optically, but radio astronomy as well, and rule out the worst-case scenarios of unlimited launches and unchecked deployments, Johnson told reporters. In response to these concerns, SpaceX has said it will take steps to color the base of the Starlink satellites black in order to minimize their brightness. Experts aren't convinced that'll work, as some observatories use super-sensitive instruments to detect even the faintest objects. Let me drop for a sec. scientists will likely have to get used to these sort of disruptions, as regulating bodies aren't lending a sympathetic ear. SpaceX has already received approval from the United States Federal Communications Commission to launch 12,000 Starlink small sats. And in October, the Elon Musk-led private space firm asked the FCC for permission to launch an additional 30,000 satellites on the top of that by mid-2020s. These satellite trains, along with their associated mega-constellations, will soon become a regular fixture of the night sky. And that doesn't include constellations that are set to be built by SpaceX's competitors, including a network proposed by OneWeb, Telsat, and Amazon. With the starry nights already obscured by light pollution from our cities, it seems an unhindered view into space may soon elude astronomers as well. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
GX.
Yes, Rich.
I was going to ask about regulation, but I think you've already answered my question. There isn't any regulation. This is very analogous to pollution of our environment, and no one cares, or very little is done about it, and it's too late. WB2GXM.
I think the people at the wheel have decided that business good, and so anyone who wants, if you're interested in launching a few thousand things up into space, then they'll probably give you approval as well. So maybe we should all just launch things.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Well, you have 8,000 operational satellites right now, and then there's probably about 20 more thousand that are not operating that are still flying around in space. Most of them are in geosynchronous orbit, but this guy's putting them in a relatively low orbit. They're not big. They're not massive things like, you know, some of the ones in geosynchronous are probably as big as a school bus, where these are all 500-pound satellites. So they're a lot smaller, but they do have solar arrays sticking out of it. Each one has one solar array coming out of probably around 6 or 7 feet long. And that's, it does have four thrusters on it. So they're launching them at the lowest possible altitude because there's so many of them on there. It's the heaviest weight that SpaceX launched. Each launch is over 30,000 pounds. So he launches them at a low altitude, and then with the Hall thrusters, he moves up. He'll probably go from 180 to probably almost 400 mile elevation. So it'll help a little bit by getting them up higher. But still, I mean, it is being coordinated. I mean, it's coordinated with Intelsat because they have all the geosynchronous satellites up there. So they all had to be coordinated with them, and they did get approval. You're looking at probably a total of 50,000, between all the companies by the time they're done. Back to you, Ron.
Yeah, Paul, and it seems like only last year that everyone was concerned about all the junk up there and how are we going to clear it and how are we going to clean it and is it going to fall down on us? Is it going to bang into some other important piece of equipment that we have up there? But apparently this year we don't care anymore.
Well, Elon Musk has worked that problem out. They detect other satellites when they're near them, and they have capability of moving away from one another. So that's the news. And also, defective, they're at a low enough altitude where they will be able to deorbit, burn up in the atmosphere as time goes on. If they know one is bad, they could purposely deorbit them. They have the Hall thrusters on them, and they'll slow themselves down until they burn up. It's also what they were worried about was, is any piece is going to make it all the way down to the ground? Are you going to get some kind of a control box or something crashing into your pool? But it's not that way. They have it now. It's 100% it's going to burn up. They've tested every piece of material on every satellite. So they will burn up when they enter the atmosphere.
Jackson.
Yes, Rich.
Call, is a Hall thruster a standard chemical thruster?
Yeah, they're the Hall ion thrusters. Instead of using Xeon, which everybody uses, you know, the European Space Agency and NASA and Japan, they all use the Xeon gas because it's the heaviest type of gas. So they're not using that on the Hall thrusters on the Starlink. They're using krypton gas, you know. So it's I think it's something like 1/20th the price. You know, very, very cheap compared to Xeon. And, you know, you put up 30,000 satellites and you're going to want to have the cheapest possible fuel that will work. So that's what he's using. He's using krypton gas.
Thank you. Okay, any other questions or comments? We're coming to the witching hour, but if you have any questions or comments, let me know now. Okay, very well. Well, thanks everyone for participating. I hope you enjoyed the show. As always, keep in mind that if you have any topics, if you don't like what I said and want to refute, and especially if you have references, love references, or if you have any topics that you'd like me to discuss, or any puzzlers, because I could always use those, as I always say. Or if you want to get in touch with Dick for the mailbag questions, or Paul for the space report, email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@mycallsignisalphacharlie2golfsierra.com. And I will post the link to the Nano VNA manual and a couple of the stories that I did tonight at roy.ac2gs.com. And next week I'll be back again with some more stories and some more puzzles. So thanks again for the opportunity, both to Dick and Paul and to everyone who's participated. And I will turn it over to Dick so that he can turn it over to Paul. I guess I'll directly turn it over to Paul. Paul, take it away.
Okay, thanks, sir. Roy, AC2GSWS2N. And I don't think I have all that many topics here. So maybe, I know you always stick around anyway. Maybe we'll cover another topic later on if we have time. I always start off with the you know, the next roughly important launches, not all of the launches, there's too many. China has launched more rockets this year than anybody else. I think they're up to 28 rockets this year, but I don't cover all of them. There's no way. So it's just the important ones. On December 1st, you have Soyuz Progress cargo vehicle going up to the space station to supply the crew of six up there with stuff. And then just 2 or 3 days later, on December 4th, you have a SpaceX CRS Dragon cargo vehicle also going to the space station, which will dock to Unity, one of the modules. So there are plenty of supplies to the, you know, that's why they have to slow down, I think, on the EVAs. With cargo vehicles coming up and going, and you know, the EVAs might be slowed down for another week or two. Let me drop this WS2N for the SpaceNet report. With those launches, before the end of the year, SpaceX is planning to launch at least two more of those launches that Roy was talking about, the Starlink launches, where they load up 60 satellites onto each Falcon 9 rocket. You know, they stack them all neatly in there. There's no fancy release mechanisms. when it gets up, the fairings open up, and then the satellite just slowly push apart. You know, if you took like a deck of cards and just released the cards, eventually they would slowly move apart from one another in orbit. And when they get a little further apart, they actually start maneuvering in space. They have momentum wheels on them, so they could, you know, change direction without using any kind of fuel. And they have the Hall thrusters to maneuver in space, change their orbit. For now, they're putting them roughly in the 53 degree inclination. So by the time they're done, they should be able to have covered the central part of the, near the equator. Up to maybe 50, 45 degrees north and south of the equator. And they'll be able to put things into operation, they think, probably by the end of next year. They'll be able to start actually selling, subscriptions to SpaceX Internet. It's not, only going to be email, it's going to be everything. They plan on eventually transmitting down 4K TV. So everything you can get from Time Warner or Cablevision, you'll be able to get from these space companies. They mentioned OneWeb. I know they're having some financial problems. I don't know if they're going to continue on. They launched a couple of satellites already, but they're getting kind of far behind. But maybe they'll catch up. They have plans on launching, not on American rockets, but on Soyuz rockets. Russia's going to be launching them. So, someday we're going to look up and you're just going to see lights reflecting back in the dawn, or dusk. What you're seeing is really the reflection of the sun bouncing off these satellites. Iridium, they used to have it. They had the iridium flares. They were very bright. They've all been replaced. Iridium has brand new satellites, 77 new satellites. And you can't see them because they did what SpaceX did. They, first of all, they made them a little smaller, and they are on the dark side. So that means no more iridium flares to look forward to. Okay, the first topic I was really going to cover was apparently they've discovered using telescopes in Hawaii, they used a Keck telescope, staring at the moon Europa. Europa's going around Jupiter. They've discovered water vapor coming out of the planet. First time it's been confirmed. They've kind of suspected this. They know that probably without any doubt that the planet is loaded with water. It's one big ice cube, and when you look at it, and that was first noticed with the Voyager when it first did a flyby in 1979. They believe there's much water, more water on Europa because it's so thick, all the way down to maybe 60 miles or so into the below the surface, that there might be more water on Europa than all of Earth. So that's a good place to look for life. They need certain ingredients, and one of them is water. There's a lot of places with the other necessary ingredients, but most of them don't have water. And they found this with a telescope. They saw vapor shooting out of the moon. And they figured out the volume of the vapor would have been enough to fill an Olympic-sized swimming pool in 3 seconds. So, tremendous amount of water shot out of that moon. So, that's going to give them even more confidence to send another mission up there. They're planning on another one called the Europa Clipper, which will pass the moon 40 different times. It won't be orbiting the moon. They don't want to do that because the radiation would fry the spacecraft. The aerobic clipper is designed to have an elliptical orbit somewhat where it'll go near Europa and then go around Jupiter, go far enough away where at that time it'll be able to transmit information back to Earth, and then it'll go in close, take more information every time it passes, and this will go on for years. They figure around at least 40 paths during the spacecraft. Europa is so far in, it's within the strongest part of the magnetic field of Jupiter. And they figured that would be the end of that. But they actually estimated the amount of water to the pound.